There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
This is Dr. Luke Campagnosi welcoming you back to Midday Mobile. I'm sitting in for Sean Sullivan and glad to be here. I have to say something. I remember Sean saying that he was going to have his intern, I guess he had a summer intern, who was going to come up with a new little jingle at the beginning.
That's right.
I'm so glad he hasn't done that. I love that jingle. Don't change it. Sean, you'll hear this on your podcast, so don't change it.
I'll let him know. Start another petition.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. All right, listen, we didn't get to finish our segment on the tolls, and I want to just do this quickly, and I've got Jackie Ziegler waiting in the wings for us to get ready to talk about the SBOE, the State Board of Education. But quickly, the Mythbusters is an attempt by ALDOT to offer propaganda instead of real and intelligent interpretations of what is out there. Okay, and one of the things that they have said that Kevin and I completely disagree with, they basically said that you cannot use the gas tax that they passed, which will go into effect in September, for this particular project. Okay, well, here's something that you need to kind of think about. The project, the gas tax is going to bring in about $320 million when it's fully implemented, okay? Great. The state's going to get 67% of it. Now, what Mythbusters is saying, well, these people want to use all of the gas tax. That's not true. No one has said anything about that. We're arguing for about a 20% of the 67%. I'm going to get math, and I'm not a math guy, but okay. But I do know that 67% of 320 is something like $240 million.
Well, there's definitely no commitment from ALDOT, as far as we can tell, to use any kind of recurring funding to help support this project. In other words, one of the ALDOT officials made the statement, well, what if we invested $100 million of the gas tax for 20 years, we still couldn't build the project? Yep. That's not true. I mean, the truth is that if you were to make a commitment, not only would you be able to build a project, but also you would actually lower the bond ratings for the additional funds that might needed to build the project. The more the state puts into the project, the less expensive the financing of the project becomes.
And along those lines, Mythbusters tells us, well, you can't use Go Mesa money. Now, I understand that there are complications with Go Mesa, but ALDOT Cooper basically says, no, it's an unconventional way, it's not satisfactory, and no one does it that way. Well, our answer to that is, well, let's get out of the box here and start thinking in a way that brings in the Go Mesa money. And to be quite honest with you, this argument about the Go Mesa money is only for a restrictive number of projects goes by the by when people like Congressman Burns sat there in a meeting with us and said, absolutely not. It is part and parcel of what can be done, particularly in terms of the use of the Go Mesa money for the evacuation areas and things like that.
Absolutely. The federal documentation on Go Mesa explicitly says hurricane fortification. And if you look at for the ramp up and development of the project, there is a risk in Go Mesa that if you had a radical Democrat regime takes over the Congress and the White House, they could divert Go Mesa back to projects that are nationwide as opposed to Gulf Coast. But while it's here, these funds could be accumulated in a fund that could be used to initiate the bridge project at a later date, which goes back to the case of we think that delay creates more opportunities to find funding like this.
Yeah, exactly, which is something that we had put in one of our Lanyap ads. Why are we rushing to do this? I know that ALDOT said that the project was supposed to kick off in August of 2020. They modified that in their briefing on the 17th of July and basically said it's not going to start until the late fall of 2020. Well, if that's the case, the election will be over. We might just know if Trump's going to be back, which I hope he is, given, you know, everything that's gone on. But the fact of the matter is, delaying a little bit is not going to create a problem in terms of their environmental impact
like that. If Trump doesn't come back, the Democrats are about giving away more money to everybody. So that means more federal direct grant type money could be available, although you'll pay the price somewhere, no doubt. But either way, the prospect of additional federal funding for key infrastructure projects is better as time goes on.
Okay. Well, listen, if you want really solid information on this project and try to answer the Mythbusters and the ALDOT propaganda, go to stopthetoll.com. Kevin and I have put this together. It really has a lot of detailed. You know, he gave me a homework assignment, okay? So I wrote a term paper here. Okay, so we did that. But the bottom line is you have got to be informed, and you need to go to those places that give you the ammunition you need to answer these things. So go to stopthetoll.com, and also go to, you know, Jim Ziegler's Facebook page. I can never remember. Block the I-10
block
toll.
Block the Mobile Bayway toll.
Thank you. Good. Okay. All right. I got an F on that one. Sorry. Okay. So that's going to wrap us up right here for this. Kevin, thank you for coming down. I really appreciate it. I'll see you later this afternoon. Now, we are now about to start embarking on another major topic. It's major for those of us who are involved in education, number one, but it is major in terms of the question about what is Alabama education going to be about? We know that Alabama education is in a crisis, okay? At least from the standpoint of what the legislators have said, finally realizing that, and here again, this is where an issue is, and that we attest, well, we would argue that the reason we are in a crisis is because of Common Core, okay? And we can argue about that. But what they have done is to take this crisis of education, which they caused, in my view, because they never would get rid of Common Core, okay? So they've created the crisis. And now, who are they blaming but the State Board of Education? And the reason is they're unhappy with the State Board of Education, and they're scapegoating them, and they're making it, you know, making the board the problem, when the reality, it has been the legislature, you know, taken care of by Billy Canary and the BCA money that kept it going, and Hubbard taking the money and Marsh taking the money. And what they do is they distribute this money out to all of their, you know, their minions, who then get enough money to take care of their campaign funding. I mean, it's a sick system, okay? So if there's a crisis of education, my view, look to the legislators, not to the State Board of Education. But so they want to get rid of the State Board of Education and make it an appointed board. Well, our local State Board of Education member is Jackie Ziegler. And Jackie, welcome to this program.
Well, thanks, Dr. Liu. Thanks for having me on.
Well, glad to have you. I know that you and I have talked about this, you know, on different occasions. But let's just kind of review the bidding here. When the legislators basically say the board is dysfunctional, okay, what is your answer to that?
Well, I always say, first of all, look at yourself. Before you cast that first stone, why not look at yourself? But so that the view of me looking at our Board of Education, we have come to the point where I think we are a highly functioning board. Now, that does not mean that we do not have at times disagreements or discussions. If we all were thinking the same way and the same, you know, that just doesn't bode well. I have learned more by being on that board, by listening to my other board members explaining issues that are prevalent or more isolated for their district. So with that, discussion does not mean dysfunctional. It means opportunities for discussion, opportunities to discuss things, and opportunities to enlighten not only our other board members, but those viewing us from, you know, live streaming or if they're in the audience.
Well, I mean, listen, I agree with that, and naturally, okay? You have the situation where disagreement cannot be seen as dysfunctional. If they're going to apply that standard, then my goodness, the state legislature just goes, they go crazy all the time. I mean, they showed on TV, they were about ready to get into a fight this year. I mean, they say some of the most horrible things to each other. So I guess the question of dysfunctionality really lies in something else, okay? And this is where I think that the answer to the dysfunctional question is along the lines of you said. But I also think that there's another aspect of this that needs to be addressed, and that is that from 2003 to 2009, the State Board of Education under, I think it was Superintendent Morton, what did they do with the Alabama Reading, you know, program? They brought it to the front. It ended up being a marvelous vehicle by which reading scores went up. And I recognize that, you know, we can say what we want about scores and all like that, but somewhere along the line, there has to be some sort of accountability. But the point is, from that particular point, 2003 to 2009, ARI was a board-instituted, you know, program that worked, right. Number three in the nation. So when you look back at that, Jackie, what is your sense then of why things got off track in terms of issues pertaining to scores decreasing after 2012?
Well, what happened, and I can speak to that because I was principal of a school and we implemented ARI to fidelity. It was properly funded. It was properly instituted. It was taken the way it was designed, and with that, it was a tremendous movement that moved our kids forward. Then there was the cutting back of the funding from our legislators. Some people do not understand. The board has the budget of which we create a budget, but it is given over to the legislators. They're the ones that have, ours is only a recommendation. We do not vote on the budget. We are just recommending it. And they, at that point in time, cut ARI to the point where it was not able to be implemented in the way it was designed. And there was the beginning of that slippery slope.
Well, you know, as part of the budget cuts, though, and again, I think that when we talked to Tripp Pittman about this, what we found was that Superintendent Bice was actually using ARI money to do what was necessary to train teachers up for Common Core, the implementation of it. I mean, if you've got a teacher that has to go to training, well, someone has to be in the classroom, so you're paying substitutes for taking care of this. So the combination of, you know, less money for ARI linked to questions about Bice misusing the money, and when we brought that to Pittman, he basically attempted to try to make sure it didn't happen. I'm still not sure whether or not that actually was worked out to the point where we were told it wasn't happening. I'm still skeptical of that. But be that as it may, you have that issue. Let me ask you this too, and I know we've had this discussion one other time. You have a situation where not only was ARI, you know, aimed at the lower grades, but my understanding is that Bice and them took the ARI approach without getting more money for it, and sent the coaches into the higher grades. Now, do you think that that possibly had another impact? And, well, you weren't on the board at the time, so you would not know. But do you think that when you got to the board, people were talking about how mismanaged this was and the degree of difficulty in terms of expanding the program into the upper grades when you only had X amount of money and you really weren't meeting the needs of the lower grades, which seemed to be where everything centered in terms of where the success rate was?
Well, and any time you have a certain amount of money, just say, let's say the pie, and that pie is only supposed to be used for K through 3, and then it's expanded, well, then the amount of money to be utilized in, again, the way it was designed always has an impact. And that's about the time we started losing our regional coaches. Then we started losing our school coaches. It was just the snowball effect that was making the program so successful that at that point it just started diminishing on its return. And that's, you know, that's always what happens when people, if it comes to a point where you think it needs to be expanded, well, then you need to go back to the designing board and then also back to the legislators to say, well, we will need additional funding or whatever will be necessary. You don't rob Peter to pay Paul, or, you know, spread the wealth, so to speak.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And we're going to go to a break in a minute, but I think it's quite clear from just this short discussion that the legislative argument placing the blame for all of this on the board, when the real issue was the degree to which the superintendent Bice, in his attempts to try to, you know, bring Common Core into fruition, it cost money, and that really did create, in my view at least, a major problem. Linking it to also the expansion of a program that was working, but if it wasn't going to be funded correctly, then you're going to have major problems. That's not a board issue, in my view. So here we are with this, and I think that that in terms of trying to make a defense for the board, just on the two issues we've talked about, it's clear that this argument that we need to move to an appointed board because the elected board is not working just doesn't stand to reason. And I think that when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this, because I think that unless the public is aware of the degree to which you have been scapegoated, then they're liable to buy into this. And I mean, and the next question I have for you is the degree to which your fellow board members are going to fight this. So we'll come back and we'll talk about that.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Lou Campagnosi sitting in for Sean Sullivan. I've got Jackie Ziegler on the line, and Jackie and I are talking about this forthcoming amendment to do away with the elected school board and bring in an appointed board. Jackie, thank you for being with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Lou. May I just mention a couple of things before we get off on another tangent?
Sure.
I just think it's important that people realize that the state of Alabama did have an appointed board up until about 1975, and then the citizens became so disillusioned with the political agenda of that appointed board that their voice came to Montgomery, and that's when we became elected.
Right. Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, anytime I'm adamantly against any time the voice of the people via the vote, you know, the voter box or whatever is being compromised, I cannot sit still and be quiet about it.
Well, and that leads me to my next question, and you and I have talked about this before, and I really think this is going to center on the degree to which your colleagues on the board are willing to go out and fight for their positions, not because they want a job, because it is a principle involved of not taking away the vote from the people, like you just said. So the question is, you've got, I think the 1, 3, 5, and 7 districts are now going to be up for election this time. So
yeah, we're on the next voter.
Yes, you're. So the question is, I mean, and I know that you publicly announced your opposition to this amendment on the board meeting, I think on the 13th of June, if I'm not mistaken. So just tell us, what is the sense of direction from the members of the board? Are they as adamantly opposed to this as you are?
Yes, I've been on the phone and as well as, you know, of course, speaking to my esteemed colleagues. And they're all going in there. They know their districts better than, you know, just as I know District 1, they know their districts,
right,
and the best way of getting their voice out. So, yes, indeed, they indeed are working their areas and letting it be known. And most of us are doing it besides, and I want to again thank you for giving us more of this public forum, but going to, you know, the civic meetings, we go to women's group, we go to the commerce meeting. So we're getting out there and getting it known, and the more our voice is being heard, the more we're being invited to speak.
Well, that's good to hear, because I know that the Alabama Conservative Coalition will be meeting on the 10th of August, and our game plan is to contest this to the very best that we can. And we're starting off with a resolution to the Alabama Republican Party. They meet in August on the 24th in Auburn. Here's the beginning of it. Resolution of the Alabama Republican Executive Committee opposing the constitutional amendment to appoint state school board members and requiring Alabama to use national standards. Parentheses, Common Core bait and switch. Listen, I mean, when they crafted this SB 397, they knew what they were doing. They were trying to make people believe that, you know, Common Core, particularly those of us who have hated Common Core, well, if you just vote for this amendment, Common Core goes away. It doesn't, okay? And I would argue that that is an awakening issue that we have got to make sure that people see the bait and switch part of this. But I guarantee you that we are in the process of raising money to put Jim as the voice of opposition to this amendment. And we're going to do what we can do, just like he's doing this up in North Alabama, just like he did it on the gas tax. He is going to make a difference in terms of making sure the public knows what's going on. And, you know, we're definitely going to be, you know, doing what we can do to assist you in making sure that this word is out. And I know that down here, you know, in your district, it's not going to be as much of a problem. But going forward, I think, you know, talking to the rest of your board members and making sure that they interact with whoever we can get in their districts is critical.
Right. And I believe that is indeed going forth. And as you and I have also spoken, we know that the vote is March 3rd of 2020. So, you know, it is an ongoing process. It is one to be vocalized. It is a getting forth information, you know, just like when I think it was Senator Marsh mentioned that we were in need of subject matter experts, of which they have to pay for. To me, that was an insult to our educators, who the teachers are in the field, are the best subject matter experts we can have.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the issues that we need to make sure people understand. But you know what? It is a political issue. And the fact of the matter is, Jackie, you're well-liked down here. And I doubt seriously if we are going to have any trouble at all keeping you in your position. Jackie, thank you for being with us today.
No,
we've got to take a hard break here.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. Sean's probably on a beach somewhere or wherever he is having a good afternoon, but we're having a better time right now, I tell you. I miss him, but I'm enjoying what we're doing, and I'm glad to have had the opportunity to be with all of y'all today. Our next to the last segment is here, and I'm really glad to have a local who is very well known to this audience, because Quinn Hillier appears with Sean every Tuesday morning from 8 to about 8:20. And the fact of the matter is that Quinn and I have known each other for quite a few years. So we have antecedents back into Newman School in New Orleans, where he went to. And the fact of the matter is that as a Washington Examiner journalist, he's done an outstanding job in terms of alerting our people down here to all sorts of issues that need to be attended to. And so, Quinn, welcome to another round of 106.5 today.
Well, thank you, Lou, and thanks for having me on, and thanks for the tireless work you do defending and promoting conservatism.
Well, thank you. We try. Okay. Well, let's get right to it. This question about Common Core, we have been in this fight for many, many years, ever since Governor Riley implemented it in 2010. just give a quick overview, if you would, why we are so opposed to Common Core.
Common Core was centrally designed by a bunch of educrats who convinced states across the country to implement it before it had even had a chance to be field tested.
Exactly.
The standards are written terribly. They're incomprehensible. They promote learning methods that actually make it harder for most kids to learn. They, since they have been implemented, test scores have either flatlined when they were rising or when they were steady, they have gone down. And they have, in short, been a disaster, just as you and I predicted. So that's the short version of it.
And that's exactly what the problem is. Now, the political problem that we have faced is that for some reason, the Business Council of Alabama has embraced Common Core. Now, what is your take on that, number one? And number two, given the fact that Billy Canary is gone, have you seen any movement away from Common Core by the new leadership in the BCA?
I have not checked with Katie Britt or her new team. I have understood, though, that the BCA is still for Common Core, which means they are not looking at the evidence. They are not looking at the declining test scores, both nationally and in Alabama. But that doesn't surprise me. Look, when Billy Canary was there, I specifically asked Billy Canary, okay, what is in Common Core? Why do you support it? And he said, well, I'm for high standards. I said, yeah, but what are the standards? What makes Common Core good? He couldn't tell me. He had no clue what was in them. I asked his lobbyists the same thing. They had no clue. I was writing for a Louisiana paper, so I went to the head of the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry, asked them the same question. They had no clue what was in Common Core. They just said, oh, well, we're for national standards. Duh. What is in this that actually is good? They don't have a clue. I went to their leading legislator in Louisiana who carried the water for them. He had no idea what was in them. So if the BCA wants to still support it, somebody should make the BCA explain why it is that they like flatlined and dropping test scores nationally and tremendously dropping test scores in Alabama when we had risen to 25th in the nation and are now back to about 48.
Okay, so
somebody needs to get them to explain that, because right now they can't.
And I think that that's exactly where the problem is at this particular juncture, because you've got, you know, Del Marsh. He at least admitted there's an education crisis, which is something that we've been saying for a long time, but no one in Montgomery wanted to listen to that. But now, the cat's out of the bag. There is a crisis. Now, our argument, it is directly related to Common Core. The other people say, well, it's not necessarily Common Core. It's because it wasn't implemented correctly. We haven't given it time, not enough funds. What's your answer to that?
I would read the actual standards from the official Common Core standards. These are not some sort of implementing guidelines that some state came up with. This is from the official document of Common Core. I give you just three sentences. This is from the manual for the teachers to understand what they're supposed to do with Common Core math. And I quote, mathematically proficient students bring two complementary abilities to bear on problems involving quantitative relationships. One is the ability to decontextualize, to abstract a given situation and represent it symbolically and manipulate the representing symbols as if they have a life of their own without necessarily attending to their reference. The second is the ability to contextualize, to pause as needed during the manipulation process in order to probe into the reference for the symbols involved. Now, wow. If you can find a single math teacher in Alabama who can tell me what that gobbledygook means and tell me or you why that gobbledygook helps them teach arithmetic to our students, I will give you $10,000.
Well, I understand that, I appreciate the offer, but I'm going to pass on that. But here's the thing. We know these scores are declining, and yet, you know, when Michael Sentence was in as the superintendent, he put together various committees, three different committees. One was math, English, and I forgot what the other one was. But the fact of the matter was, the math committee basically, you know, did not necessarily go down the road of getting rid of Common Core math because the Alabama professor who's over there really thinks highly of it. Yet James Milgram, who is the premier math guy in the nation, basically said no to Common Core math. He would not validate these standards. And as you said, they are just gobbledygook. So I guess the question remains, why is it in the face of the evidence, in the face of the conceptual problems that are there, that some of these educators are still wedded to Common Core?
Well, you tell me why the educators for nearly 50 years now have been trying to push things like so-called new math and all these other things that have never worked. They don't work. The English standards are just as bad.
Right.
And again, I have actually sat through a training session for hours where they teach the teachers how to teach Common Core math. And it's like a mass psychological exercise. It's all this cheering and you know, sort of inspirational, well, you're playing these games and aren't the games fun, and therefore isn't this all going to be wonderful? And you look at it and you wonder what teaching kids to pause as needed during the manipulation process has to do with teaching 5 + 5 = 10.
Yeah,
well, I mean, it's outrageous. Let me read one other thing. This is much shorter. Okay, arithmetic is supposed to be something where you are dealing with precise figures, right? And you're trying to get an answer. You're trying to get a correct answer. Mm-hmm. It's not some sort of hypothetical,
right,
you know, theory. Mathematically proficient students, now I'm quoting from Common Core, are comfortable making assumptions and approximations to simplify a complicated situation, realizing that these may need revision later. So it's okay if you just sort of guess at what the mathematical answer is and then maybe go back later and fix it. Well, that's not how it works in accounting. That's not how it works in engineering. You have to get it right.
Exactly.
That's not what they teach in Common Core.
And you know what's so frustrating to kids who are good with math? Because the process isn't followed correctly, they get lower grades because they didn't follow the process. I mean, it is absolutely absurd, you know.
It's absurd, and every member of the state school board, whether elected or appointed, and right now, thank goodness we got them elected, they should vote to repeal the 2010 resolution that affiliated Alabama with Common Core. There is no reason not to do it, and if they want to save an elected school board, then they will show that they're worth electing by repealing the 2010 resolution that adopted Common Core. If they don't do that, then they should get voted out of office one way or the other.
Well, I completely agree with you, and from a political standpoint, it seems like they have all of the cover they need, given the fact that Marsh and others have said, okay, there's a crisis of Alabama education, he's blamed Common Core. What more do they need? And I think that that's a message that we have got to carry on the rest of the summer to make sure that the Board of Education gets the message that you just said. Let me ask you this. Are you going to write a column on Common Core and arguing along these lines to get rid of it now and take advantage of the political windfall that we've got because they finally realized how bad it is?
I mean, I've written several dozen columns on Common Core over the last 6 or 7 years. When it is an appropriate time, anytime Common Core itself might be coming up for a vote, I will certainly weigh in.
That's well, let's press on them to come up with this and see where we're going to go with it, because it seems to me that this is the time to do it. Quinn, thank you so much for all of you.
Thank you, Lou.
You have done
it.
We'll be in touch. You take care. Thank you.
You too.
So there you have it, folks. We're going to another break here, but Common Core is something that we have got to continue to fight against, along with keeping our school board. Let's get rid of Common Core and let's give our kids a real education, not this phony baloney approach where 2 and 2 is really 3. You got it? Okay, we don't need that. Thank you all very much. We'll be back with our final segment in just a few minutes.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. Now, listen, I have to say, I enjoyed listening to myself on that commercial there. That wasn't bad. You guys have got to get out there and call Governor Ivey and tell her no tolls. All right, last segment. And for this last segment, I want to really talk a little bit about what's going on in college. I mentioned earlier that Professor Tom Hoffman, who is the chair of the political science department at Spring Hill College, where I am an adjunct, is on the line with us, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of these issues that pertain to the college experience in the classroom. Tom, welcome.
Hello, How you doing, Lou?
I'm doing pretty good. I mean, we're getting close to the end of our midday Mobile, program. It's been a good day, and I really wanted to cap it off with a good discussion with you about a couple of topics, if we have enough time to get them all in. So the first thing I want to ask you, how do you explain the degree of anti-Americanism that is seen on some of these campuses? Not necessarily Spring Hill, where you've been there for a while, or on Tulane's campus, where I taught for a long time before I came to Spring Hill. What is your sense of why that has developed?
Well, I think there's sort of a dynamic within the academic community. You were talking about high school and Common Core earlier, so I think it's logical to kind of go to the next level in the educational process. And I think a lot of, I mean, it's a little bit of a cliche, but a lot of the attitudes in higher ed come from, I think, from the fights of the 1960s. And there's among many of today's professors, they may not have been student radicals themselves, but they absorbed this attitude that the only way to really be intelligent is to be critical. And they find that it's convenient and easy to turn that critical lens to protect, to some particular targets.
Well, I think that, when it comes to American foreign policy, that certainly is an easy target. It's certainly easy in terms of American history with, the various warts that are there. I mean, there's no problem that those issues were there. But, what I've found is that in terms of trying to defend American foreign policy, it seems to me that somewhere along the line, people are missing some major pieces here. And I would suggest that, particularly in terms of the Cold War, the criticism has been, our foreign policy got in bed with all these dictators in order to prevent the spread of communism. But that was a transgression of American values.
Right.
What is your sense of that? And I have an answer to it, but I want to just get your thoughts on that particular thing.
Well, I think my first reaction is that it's very easy in retrospect to look at decisions made and alliances concluded and judge those as deficient, and certainly there were a lot of mistakes made. We went up a lot of blind alleys, I think, coalitionally. But then in retrospect, when you're looking back, it's all too easy, I think, to hold to an impossible standard and to kind of forget the contingencies that are going on at the moment that are kind of driving some of those decisions.
Well, and I think that along those lines, I mean, just think about this. In World War II, we ended up getting bed with Stalin, okay? A mass murderer, even worse than
Hitler.
Yeah,
it doesn't get much worse than that, does it?
Exactly, And so run the reel forward to today. And basically what I say, once we got in bed with Stalin, then I don't want to really hear a lot about these moral ambiguities. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So run the reel up to today, and we have this big issue over Saudi Arabia and Khashoggi being killed, the journalist, which is terrible, I understand. But
right.
If you don't frame this along the lines of the geopolitical issues pertaining to Iranian hegemony, which is very much what they want, and Saudi Arabia is a bulwark against that, I mean, what is the point of having a discussion if you can't see that?
Right, and I think you're right. You do have to take into account the larger geopolitics. It's not just you're making a decision and it can be judged moral or immoral deciding who you're aligned with. There's a reason for these alliances. Now, you can argue on any given case, and I go back and forth on the Saudi alliance myself sometimes, but I do think you're right. I think oftentimes we're put blinders are kind of put on the conversation, so you just focus on what the U.S. government decision was at this point without sort of considering what else is going on.
Yeah, I mean, the context of getting into Vietnam, I mean, Johnson was faced with a very difficult problem in that not only was Vietnam an ally of ours, a bulwark against the expansion of communism, which everyone said was, okay, the domino theory. But not to get in the weeds on this, but the point is Johnson was not going to let Vietnam go down the tube, and neither was, you know, George Bush going to let Saddam become a threat. And so, you know, you make decisions.
Right, right. And, I do think the Vietnam decisions have been hashed over so much, and the Iraq war decision has also, you know, had such a big role in shaping attitudes, and they continue to be talked about. But I think there, too, you do have to put yourself back into that context a little bit in order to be fair to the decision makers at the time.
I think so. Let me just quickly turn to a topic that you and I have talked about before. And I mentioned to you this article about great books for a brainwashing. It happens to do with the summer reading list some of these colleges have. And, I mean, they're really trying to turn folks into little social justice warriors, which, look, social justice is a concept that I really don't think you can define, but nevertheless, you know, I know when it doesn't exist, you know, Stalin's Russia, but what is your sense of that, okay?
About why they have those.
Yes, about why are we driven to the social justice issue when, you know, if you're just, particularly in this country, when there's been so much improvement. And I recognize that, you know, here we are, we're sitting at a certain position. We're not walking in everyone's shoes. But on the other hand, there have been major reforms in this country since 1965, whether it's on race relations, whether it's on social issues or any number of issues.
Well, again, I think that academics tend to be socialized into thinking that they have to be critical. I don't think they're always self-critical. In fact, they're often not very good at criticizing their own orthodoxies, which are sort of preeminent in the academy these days. But they can turn easily to criticize aspects of American society that they think are backwards, and so I think when they get together in faculty committees to choose these books, they tend to think pretty like-minded. There's very little diversity, intellectual diversity, in academia right now.
Well,
I think that's probably
you just have to keep hiring me back, because there's some diversity right here, I'll tell you. Listen, Tom, thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate you coming on and sharing with us, because it is important for people to hear from people who are in the trenches in these colleges. You know, everyone's not on the Looney Tunes movement, you know, so
I think that's right, and I appreciate it, Lou, to give me an opportunity to talk to this issue, because when I'm out and about, I do hear people who think that it is completely that way, and it's not. I mean, it's not. There is a lot of anti-American attitudes. There's a lot of sort of right thinking, so to speak, orthodoxy that's pushed on American campuses. But I think there are still people who are open-minded and are willing to entertain a full range of ideas, including conservative ideas. But you're right, it's just so hard to...
Well, I appreciate your thoughts on that, and thanks for coming on today, and I'll be talking to you soon. Thank you.
All righty, Lou. Thanks.
All right, folks, we're at the end of our rope here. I don't know if I should say that, but nevertheless, we're about to wind it up, and I want to thank Dalton and Philip for handling everything today, and certainly want to thank Sean for giving me the opportunity to be here today.